Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this Innovation Forum webinar. In lieu of our face-to-face meeting, which we're all supposed to be having right now in London, thank you for joining us for this Ethical Trade and Human Rights webinar series. For the next 45 minutes or so, we shall be discussing disclosure levels, what's expected of companies, and how is that likely to evolve on this complex issue of ethical trade and human rights. And I am delighted that we have three expert speakers here to talk through their perspectives. So we're going to be hearing from Phil Bloomer from the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre, the weekly newsletter of which is probably the most essential reading on the subject. So congratulations, Phil, for the work you guys do. We're then going to hear from Camille Lepors, who is working for the Corporate Human Rights Benchmark, which has done some pioneering work to put these issues particularly on the investor and corporate agendas. And then we'll hear from Linda Kromyong from Samsung, I think a company we're all familiar with, and Linda is the Global Labour and Human Rights Director, and she's going to talk in a bit more detail about what Samsung is doing in this space, particularly around disclosure. So welcome to all of you. I'm going to ask Phil just to sort of set the scene, really, and perhaps name some names. You know, we've done this many times, Phil, usually face-to-face, and you're usually pretty good at calling out some good performance and some bad performance. I'm looking forward to creating a bit of edge to start with. then we'll hear from Camille on how the benchmark is making an impact, and then, as I mentioned, from Linda. So thanks, all of you, for joining us. And Phil, over to you to kick us off by being provocative.
Thanks very much, Toby. That's great. And thanks to everybody for coming. I think I just want to say firstly that, you know, what is the expectation of disclosure and how will it evolve? Well, I think, it's a fait accompli that the expectation is that disclosure is going to increase and probably inexorably, and particularly in key geographies like the European Union. I think that's because there's a real sense that the current business models that we have are unsustainable, both in terms of climate and the externalization of environmental costs, as well as in terms of the outcomes in inequality and the externalization of social costs. So a lot of people are now trying to find better business models. And of course, the first thing we have to do there is get transparency about what is currently the state of play. So that's why mandatory transparency is coming much more to the fore, but we're also seeing many of the companies prepared to take that action. But again, transparency is an absolutely necessary but insufficient condition for change. So it's got to be transparency that leads to action. And you can see that, for instance, with the European Union, I think now with the move towards mandatory human rights and environmental due diligence, that's all about using that transparency on due diligence to change the calculus of risk in boardrooms regarding the way that they would treat social and environmental risk. And again, from a more voluntary side, the leading companies are using transparency to really empower their stakeholders because they're disclosing more, but they're also doing that in ways that empower stakeholders to enhance the company's ESG performance. So if you just take, let's move straight to, perhaps the world's foremost legislation on corporate transparency, which is the European Union's Non-Financial Reporting Directive. The Alliance for Corporate Transparency, which the Resource Centre is part of, issued its second report in February this year on the second year of the implementation by looking at 1,000 companies across the European Union. Now, the pattern that came out of that follows very similar trends across the benchmarks, but you'll hear much more in detail from Camille. So, for instance, the good news is that 90% of the companies are reporting under the Non-Financial Reporting Directive, as they should. However, that you then get only 25% of those companies actually providing useful reporting on climate and human rights risks that have been identified and the way that they are dealing with that and the approach to those risks. So there's a lot of immaterial disclosure that's going on. That 25% then drops to just 4% of the companies that really report on the outcomes of their risk management, what happens. So you've got this drop from 90 down to 25 and then down to 4% in terms of the quality of reporting on risk assessment. Now that then, I think, just follows. I was asked to say a little bit about the companies that are doing well and the companies that are laggards, lagging behind. If you look at the at our benchmarks such as Know the Chain, you'll know that I'm also involved in a great supporter of the corporate human rights benchmark, but I'm going to leave that to Kamib. So looking at our Know the Chain benchmark, 119 of the largest global companies in three high-risk sectors. In terms of the good performers, nobody's going to be surprised that I pull out Adidas. But I want to say why. Because first of all, it discloses a huge amount of important information regarding its approach to human rights and environment, but it also does it in ways which is relevant and empowering to workers. So its grievance mechanism, for instance, it's public about what is received, about how it is dealt with, and about the outcomes of those grievances that have been lodged. That builds trust amongst the workers to actually bring more cases so that Adidas is able to make the adjustments and to their supply chains and operations. Again, they're very clear, as a rising number of companies are, about who is the responsible person who's the person that's assigned responsibility for human rights and for environmental issues. So who amongst the executives, who amongst the board? That demonstrates that governance is strong. The weaker companies say, we have a team working on this, and that's it. Again, ICT, moving to ICT for a minute, I think we'd pull out HP and Apple, who are increasingly being very explicit about the reimbursement of recruitment fees that they're paying in the lower tiers, the scale and the scope of that repayment. And again, I'd say ASOS is one that I'd pull out for saying how it works with unions and what it expects from its supply chain in terms of of the manufacturer's engagement with union. That's very important for this form of disclosure is very important and empowering to workers. But of course, I'll also say a few words about bad guys. So looking at ICT, Broadcom in the US, it's a semiconductor giant. It's got more than 100 billion in market cap. It's got extraordinarily bad disclosure. Really no standards are described, no engagement with peers, no effort at collective action. Again, Amazon, I think, is poor for its size. It's scoring an average across our Know the Chain benchmarks. But given its size, it just is not doing anywhere near enough, given the scale of risk in its operations and supply chains. And in Amazon's case, of course, it is very much their operations as well as their supply chains. So they do now disclose a supplier map, and that's a really significant move forward. But it's just not sufficient, I think, for a company of that size. Finally, I just mentioned LVMH. That's an apparel luxury brand that does Louis Vuitton, Christian Dior and Prada. They have really no disclosure regarding a worker's voice. No engagement with unions or workers is reported. There's very little on recruitment or training in their supply chains regarding forced labor. So you can see there that there's really some very low performers. I think I'd finally just say, even on the modern slavery registry that we have with the 7,600 statements, 23% of those 7,600 statements meet the minimum requirements of the legislation. And the vast majority are still putting out one side, two siders, when we know they've got massive global supply chains in high risk regions with high risk commodities. So we just expect more than that, I think, for people who are taking this seriously. And those people may end up getting, bitten in the bottom later on when due diligence laws come in. So in conclusion, I think I'd say too many companies are wasting time reporting data that is just not relevant or powerful to making change happen and empowering people in their supply chains. But the leading companies are preparing for mandatory disclosure on due diligence, and that means they're really able to make risk assessment, report on it, as well as the preventive action that they're taking. They're also reporting on action action in their operations and supply chains, such as mapping, reimbursement of recruitment fees in lower tiers. But perhaps most importantly, the real leaders are reporting on issues immediately relevant to their stakeholders and in ways that empower stakeholders to help improve the company's ESG performance. And with the move now by people, even from Larry Fink, et cetera, to say we want to invest in companies with purpose and those that are taking the stakeholders and not only the shareholders into account, I think those are the companies that will benefit greatly over the next period. Back to you, Toby.
Bill, thanks very much. Very helpful overview. Camille, love to hear your perspective about your most recent research, what you're finding, levels of interest and so on. Just very briefly, just tell our listeners very briefly what your organization does, and then let's move into the meat of things. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Toby. And just before I go into the CHRB, I wanted to say well done to you and the team for making sure we're having this discussion in spite of the unusual circumstances. So thanks for that. So for those not familiar with the Corporate Human Rights Benchmark, or CHRB, we essentially benchmark the largest global companies from high-risk sectors on their human rights performance. And we're part of the larger World Benchmarking Alliance, which looks more generally at the contribution of businesses to the achievement of the SDGs. And of course, the protection of human rights of workers and the most vulnerable is central to this. And it's particularly evident these days. So we've published three benchmarks to date, the first one in 2017, then 2018, and the last one last year in November. And our most recent benchmark looked at 200 companies in the agricultural products, apparel, extractives, and electronics manufacturing industries. So the way the assessment works is essentially companies are assessed around 50 indicators in six measurement themes, which are grounded on the UN guiding principles on business and human rights and other established and recognized instruments or frameworks. And companies are essentially assessed on their governance and policy commitments, on how those commitments are then embedded into the company's management systems. They're assessed on human rights due diligence, grievance mechanisms, and the provision of remedy, practices in relation to specific human rights risks, responses to serious allegations of negative impacts, and particularly relevant to this conversation on transparency. And transparency is actually assessed throughout because the assessment is based exclusively on publicly available information. So that's company disclosures mostly, but also disclosures from third parties, such as NGO reports or news investigation pieces. So that's the framework for the assessment. Now, what did the 2019 results tell us? Well, companies are scored out of 100, and the average total score in 2019 was 24%. So very low scores on average, and over half of the companies assessed scored less than 20%. And those scores are actually low across the six measurement areas, even though they do drop even lower when we look at specific practices as opposed to policy commitments on average. Nearly half of the companies assessed scored zero on human rights due diligence. And the number of companies mapping their supply chain, even though it's increasing, it's still a minority of companies doing it. And when we look at cases of negative impacts or alleged negative impacts, the provision of effective remedy is extremely low. So more specifically, We looked at about 150 allegations last year, and companies provided remedy that is satisfactory to the victims in only 3% of those cases. So we really see when we break down the results that they're low overall, and then even lower when we look at specific practices and remedying impacts. And of course, those results are concerning because they suggest low levels of implementation of the UNGPs by major companies in high-risk sectors. However, it's not all bad news. We did see some progress. So when we look at the companies that have been in the benchmark for 3 years in a row, we see the average scores going up each year. So 75% of those repeat companies that have been in the benchmark for 3 years have actually improved their score. And a few companies are actually showing a lot of improvement. For example, Danone, Diageo, Eni, Fast Retailing, Heineken, Kellogg, PTT, or Repsol, to give a few examples from the different sectors, have improved by more than 30 percentage points since 2017. And some leading companies, Phil has mentioned Adidas, but also Unilever, Marks and Spencer's, score above 70%, actually thereby demonstrating that it is possible to do well and to score well and to disclose that level of information. By contrast, the new companies which were added in 2019 for the first time are not doing so well, and they're therefore dragging the overall average down. So worst performers are typically companies that disclose very little information, if any, about their human rights commitments, human rights risks, and approach to tackling those risks. It's problematic for a number of reasons, which Phil just touched upon and which we can go back to in a moment as well. But crucially, from an external stakeholder's perspective, it's impossible to tell if this absence of disclosure reflects an absence of action and even care for those topics, or if there is a lot happening, but the company is just not talking about it in the public domain. But we know the risks are there. So the question is how they're being dealt with, and we can only know that based on what companies disclose. So I'd leave it here for now in terms of the overview of the results, and hand it back to you, Toby.
Thank you very much, Camille. That's very, very helpful. So we've had some really useful opening remarks, giving us a sense of the scene and where we are, though, of course, it's complicated and different across different sectors. And as we know, there's a huge hidden number of companies who have enormous impacts who do absolutely nothing in this space. So we have to remember that perspective as well. But Samsung is definitely not one of those. So Linda, very much looking forward to hearing your remarks about the work you've been doing in the space of disclosure. I know the company's come a very long way, particularly in the last 5 years or so on this. So looking forward to hearing from you. And listeners, do remember, lots of time for questions here. So if you can use the question box and keep your questions fairly short, then I shall be able to put them to our panelists. So do think of some, and I shall put them to Linda, Phil and Camille in a moment. But for now, Linda, over to you, looking forward to hearing your remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony, and thank you indeed for making this possible. Maybe just a few words about Samsung, about myself. I joined Samsung end of 2018, and before that I worked for the International Organization of Employers Secretary General. Tony, you made a remark, Samsung came a long way, and I do recognize that. And maybe just to share with everyone on the call that from when I joined and from what I could see from the external perspective, I have identified that Samsung is doing better than what the external world does. And I think that's one of the questions also being posed by Camille and also by Phil. How do you encourage being more transparent about what is really happening within companies? A few more remarks about Samsung Electronics, because I'm representing Samsung Electronics and not the other Samsung brands. And yes, you know it's from your phones, from your TVs. But what many may not know is that we also are the largest producer of chips, and that we are a supplier to many other big brands on this one. What many also may not know is that we do manufacture over 90% in-house. So we've got huge production sites in many countries. It doesn't mean we don't have a supply chain, but for those that we own in our own manufacturing, we also have, I would say, full control about what we're doing there. And labor and human rights are really relevant for us. Health and safety is an important component, but also making sure that our people understand what labor and human rights is about. And that's why we're also going to really focus heavily in 2020 on education and training on labor and human rights. Coming back to benchmarking and, you know, sharing externally what companies are doing, how we are tackling issues, what is relevant for us. At this point in time, our main channel to communicate what we're doing is our sustainability report, which is issued once a year. And this is, I would say, no different than many of the other companies. What we also see, and that's what you also acknowledged, Tony, is that we have become more open over the last year in sharing not only what we have in place, but also the issues that we have, how we're dealing with those, but also what we're working towards in the future. And that is because our stakeholders expect us to do so. With regards to our stakeholders, we see that they can drive change. And if I may give one practical example here, the fact that we have established a dedicated diversity and inclusion unit within our company since the beginning of this year was a clear result of our frequent questions being asked by investors and other stakeholders. What we also observe that in sharing what we are doing, this is not easy. It's not easy for many reasons. For those of you who work with other corporates, getting the information, getting the data, making sure that you know every day what's happening is not easy. Adding additional data to your data set is not easy. But also agreeing internally about the benefits of being more open, as well as the risk of being more open, is sometimes leading to having challenging discussions with management, you know, to really move them to say your approach that, yes, there's always risk if you start sharing what you're doing, but there might be a higher risk in the current area where we're in if you not share. And what is more important to share is not that you're perfect, but yet you acknowledge your issues and that you're working to address those. What we have seen over the last years is that we have become more open about the issues, that we start communicating faster if you have them, that we also communicate that we're looking into them, that we come back when we found the solutions and the issues identified, but then also learn from those and put those into, say, actions that, you know, are going to prevent issues from happening in the future. We will never be sure, and we always have issues, but I think that's what we should do as companies. If we look into the corporate human rights benchmark and Know the Chain, and both were mentioned by Camille and by Phil, we see that we the ranks that we have, especially in the corporate human rights benchmark, which was the first time for us, we achieved a score of 39.6% and being number four in the ICT sector. We acknowledge that this is a good start. We have to say that the bandwidth was within what we had expected from our first analysis. We had expected maybe others to score a bit higher. So I think that also shows the importance of being open and sharing publicly what you're doing. But we clearly acknowledge as well there's room for improvement and more work to be done, not only in working internally on our policies and procedures, but also what is it that we disclose and what point in time. If we are looking into our sustainability report and 2020, that one is now on its way. It's planned to be published mid of this year. The discussions that we have internally with all the relevant departments about what is it that we can disclose more. So we're hoping to do better there. We also hope that we will be able to start sharing more about new policies, about oversight, about how we have provided remedy, but also about, say, indicators, you know, that really track our progress there. But it's really the start of a journey. With regards to coming back maybe just one more time towards, say, the stakeholder engagement, I already mentioned investors as a driving force. But there is many others that are relevant to us as well. We are learning by doing that reaching out proactively, but also when there are issues and keeping them ahead of things that are happening is really appreciated. And that it's not working counterproductive in the sense that we are being blamed for having issues. Stakeholder engagement is also not a one-off, but it should require, I would say, an ongoing dialogue. And that is of importance to us, where we will focus on more in the future. One remark, also coming back to remark made by Phil, yes, we do observe more binding regulation. I am absolutely aligned with Phil's remark that also we will have more binding regulation and that increasing transparency is an important driver. But I also want to share here my concern that from a company perspective, there's many benchmarks, there's many reporting standards, and that's not always making our life easy in finding the right balance, making sure we've got the resources. And it also therefore means that sometimes companies take decisions, you know, to focus on one or the other and maybe less focus on whatever, a new instrument or a new topic. So having an aligned view on there, and hopefully the World Benchmark Alliance is going to enable that, is, I would say, of crucial importance to companies to make sure that we also put our efforts where they can add most value. And that's not only on the reporting side, but it's really on driving change internally. Tony, I would say over to you, and thanks for your time.
Thanks very much. Can I ask you, Linda, for a little bit more about investors and how investors are responding to disclosure in either from you guys or allegations that are made in the media? I know one company in particular in Southeast Asia, they now every time allegations are made now, often unfounded actually, or exaggerated, shall we say, they instantly get, they were telling me, you know, 25 emails and letters from investors, which takes up an enormous amount of their time to respond, and they don't feel it terribly material. Obviously, it's helpful in a way to keep things on the radar, but I just wondered what the sort of response is and the sort of proactiveness of investors is around the disclosures that you're making at the moment.
I think like any companies, there's many investors, but some investors are more important than the others. And also some investors do feel that ESG and especially the S is more relevant than others. So when we have issues and when they, say, reach the public domain, we try to respond openly. And we also use there very much a Business Human Rights Resource Center in really making sure that our response is made public. With some investors, there is an ongoing, I would say, dialogue on topics, also during the Investor Roadshow. And what we're learning to do now is that not only this engagement is taking place via investor relations, but also by, for example, using me to have this engagement and more specifically focus on labor and human rights. I don't think we will ever be able to prevent them from reaching out to us. And to some investors, depending on the issue, we also decided internally, but that's really a case-by-case approach, that if we are aware of issues that we really assess this is really something important and relevant and will be and will have the attention and requires the attention of Samsung and its investors, that to some investors we reach out proactively to share it with them. And that, I think, you know, enables us to manage it more appropriately and prevent them from, say, bombarding us with questions. But that's a case-by-case approach.
Okay, thank you. That's very helpful. So in order to stimulate further discussion, I have one comment followed by one excellent question. So the comment is, and Phil, you're going to like this. Phil's comments are also interesting. On Amazon's supplier map, they only share it as a PDF, which from a data perspective makes it virtually impossible to work with. They also don't list which part of their supply chain each supplier belongs to. So specialist advocacy for workers in those supply chains becomes difficult. So I think that's quite an interesting comment. Perhaps if anyone wants to come back on that later, they can. On to our question, what is the role of civil society and stakeholders in this process? During these webinars, we see a proliferation of different groups, many of them running similar scoring and benchmarks and promoting different initiatives. Some of these groups need to monetize their services to maintain their work. How do companies differentiate between the standards or organizations to partner with to enhance their disclosures? Well, that's a good one. Phil, you were praised initially, so hopefully that dopamine hit will have inspired you to answer this question first. So over to you.
Thanks very much. Yes, I mean, those are two excellent questions and hit the nail on the head. I mean, just a quick remark on the remark. I think that, you know, what is described there really illustrates the way in which some companies have not yet understood that many of their stakeholders can really help them enormously improve their ESG performance. But unless they are empowered, it is simply impossible for them to do so, and you will get a resentment building up. And I think that's, again, remarks by Linda, you know, regarding what's happening in Samsung is the antithesis of what is exemplified by the way Amazon is presenting that that result. So it's, you know, what we're trying to do as the resource center is constantly, a bit like the way Linda's also described it, we're trying to present through the benchmarks, through all the information that we have available, to empower people to be able to really help in the transformations that are necessary in the business models over the next 5 and 10 years as we go through these extraordinary transitions. And so that for me is exemplary of that. On the second one, well, I'll be very clear on this, and that is, I think you have to look at the international standards. And you, and to decide whether a benchmark or a survey is worth the candle, and whether some of the investor research agencies are worth the effort, I think you've got to look at whether they are tying themselves to the international standards of the Paris Accord and the UN guiding principles. And that's why, you know, it, and I'm sorry if it sounds like blowing our own trumpets, but the corporate human rights benchmark and Know the Chain are the two that score 100% in terms of their alignment with the UN guiding principles. We're trying to drive change based on those international standards. I think if you go to MIT, to the site there, you will see that there is, they've done a massive correlation of all the different benchmarks that there are and the different investor research agencies' scores for companies. There is almost no correlation between any one top 10 and the top 10 of another agency. So we've got an enormous confusion, which is why we've also got things like the European Union now moving not only to have due diligence mandatory, but to also say, for instance, on investors, we have to be able to say, in the sustainable finance plan, they're insisting that there is a clear taxonomy that will distinguish between portfolios that describe themselves as green and those that really are green. And you're going to see more and more of that differentiation based on those international standards, I think.
Thanks very much. Camille, would you like to add anything to that?
Yes, thank you. Just on the role of civil society in this process, for us, because the assessment of the CHRB is based a lot on disclosures from companies, but also on allegations and how companies respond to these allegations, I see two essential roles that civil society plays in that. The first one is to actually voice the issues and allegations of negative impacts when they occur, because this is how we can then pick them up and look at how companies responded to them. And the second way is nearly as a verification tool, because we can't, essentially we take what companies disclose in their reporting at face value. So we analyze it and we make sure that it meets our requirements. But if a company says that it does X or Y on child labor, then we score them according to what they say. And so it's essential to have actors in civil society, but also other stakeholder groups, but civil society is key there, to essentially check that this is true and that this is happening on the ground, and that what is being disclosed matches what happens in reality.
Okay, thanks very much. We've got a few other questions coming in here, which I'll ask Anita if you want to comment on. A quick one for you, Camille, specifically. Someone's asking, do you intend to extend the benchmark to other sectors and industry?
Yes, so this year we are extending it to companies in the automotive manufacturing industry, so car companies. After this, we don't have a specific plan for which sector we look at. We have been discussing the finance sector and also other high-risk sectors like construction or hospitality. But this will very much depend on what the World Benchmarking Alliance at large will be looking at and in which circumstances, because as Linda highlighted, we don't want to replicate efforts and we don't want to also create confusion as to what is expected. So automotive for now, and afterwards no clear decision, but the idea is of course to expand.
Thank you. And somebody else, sorry Phil, go ahead.
Just a quick one, just to say we're also we're working very closely with the Corporate Human Rights Benchmark. We're also doing one right now, and there'll be a benchmark coming out in just a couple of months on the renewable sector, because we are deeply concerned that the transition to a zero carbon economy has to be fast, and if it's going to be fast, it has to be fair, because otherwise we're going to get all the kind of suspensions that slow down the implementation of the transition to zero carbon economies. So we are worried that the renewable sector is still on average not a high performer in this area of ESG. So that's why we'll also be putting that benchmark out soon. And just finally, the MIT, I just Googled it, I couldn't remember its name. The MIT study I was referring to is called Aggregate Confusion, and it's in the MIT Sloan School. Back to you, Toby.
Thanks very much, Phil. So a few more comments and questions coming in here. Perhaps a question for all of you, but perhaps Linda, you might want to start off with your perspective on this one. Somebody asking about the role of advocacy. So they're suggesting that the role of disclosure should include advocacy by businesses, and could this be included in benchmarking? Advocacy also creates change. So Linda, perhaps you could comment on the emerging role of companies like Samsung on the advocacy side.
Yeah, thank you, Tony. And if you allow me, I will also bring in a bit, say, my previous expertise with regards to advocacy. Samsung, and I think that's the case for many companies, you know, advocating, you know, can be done in many in many different ways. We are a member of the Responsible Business Alliance, but we're also a member of employers' federations across the globe. So whether or not we choose to have, say, direct advocacy really depends on the topic as well as on the region. If I may give you, say, one example about where we feel that, say, joint action is helpful, because also advocacy to some extent is action, issue that has been raised, which is also available on Business Rights Resource Center website, about allegation on Uyghur, say, forced labor in China. Is this something that one company has a solution to? No. Does this require collaborative action from business? Yes, in not only exercising due diligence and really finding out what's happening, but also in engaging with relevant stakeholders. Is there a strong government component? Yes, as well. So advocacy, yes, I think that's relevant and important, and we need to speak out. Whether or not a company chooses to do that directly or indirectly via bodies such as the IOE or the RBA, I think that will depend on each company as well as on the topic as such. Maybe Phil and Camille, you would like to comment further on this one?
Yes, thank you. And if you could both be a little bit brief, because we've still got a lot to get through. So, Camille.
Sure. So, yes, I think we see a lot of CEO advocacy, but also, an element of advocacy is actually not lobbying against regulatory measures that promote more transparency and better respect for human rights. And so that's also essential. I agree, it can create change. And actually, in the CHRB assessment, we do look at CEO advocacy on human rights matters. But on its own, it's of course not sufficient. So it's one element that can create change. But one of many.
Thank you.
Just briefly, just reinforcing, I think, what's been said. You know, the fact is that we, for human rights due diligence and environmental due diligence in Europe, we now have over 50 German companies speaking out that they believe we need action. We need this kind of regulation introduced because they're sick of being undercut by state, by cowboys. They want that level playing field established. The same is true in Switzerland, where a number of companies alongside investment houses have spoken out strongly in that way. The only other thing I'd add is, you know, we have a business network of companies that really want to play a role in holding open civic space in society, which is a shared space for both business and civil society. And those companies are, you know, there's a number of companies now stepping forward trying to support human rights defenders because they see them as the canaries in their coal mine or in their supply chain. And we need that protection as more and more increasingly authoritarian regimes take action, often ruthless action, to silence critics in terms of irresponsible investment that goes on.
Great, thank you very much. I have someone asking about something which I'm not familiar with. So if you're not familiar with it, do say so. We can move on quickly. The Liechtenstein Initiative sounds like it might want to punch above its weight. Is it a driver for modern slavery to become the next TCFD play here, which I think means the Task Force on Climate Disclosure? So any comments on the Liechtenstein Initiative, Phil?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we hope that the Liechtenstein Initiative will gain further strength. I do believe that this is the litmus test for investors and the financial sector to work to really ensure that they are playing their full role in expunging forced labor from companies' supply chains and insisting that their own investment is not used in ways which would perpetuate that egregious abuse of our fellow human beings. It's going to take a lot for the Liechtenstein Initiative to move forward. I think it's got a lot now of the right investors, and I think that that's very important. I'm slightly worried that there is a very strong emphasis, you know, on modern slavery and not on the wider field of labor abuse in supply chains. So that would be my only concern. But I do believe it's brought together a very significant body of vital investors, and this has now got a critical mass to make change happen.
Thank you. We are short on time, so Linda, let me just ask you if you have any brief comments on the Liechtenstein Initiative. You don't have to, by the way, but if you want to say something.
I have to be honest, I just looked it up on the internet, so no comments from my side other than that I can clearly see it's indeed really only focusing on slavery and human trafficking.
Okay, thanks. Camille, any brief comment? You don't have to. If you don't want to.
Not specifically on this one, perhaps on investors, but and the role that investors play in driving more transparency in companies. And this is something Linda has touched upon, and something we hear a lot from companies is that often they're fighting for space in disclosure to talk about human rights and sustainability more broadly. And they get comments back that actually only a small proportion of the investor base is asking about those issues, and therefore that doesn't give them enough enough pressure to build on, to push for more disclosures.
Thank you. We have a classic case, a classic question here about building a business case. I mean, this is a dance as old as time itself in many ways. Do you have advice on building a business case for resources to dedicate to both disclosures and action, particularly given the difficult times we're in now with COVID-19? So, I mean, that's a question I'm sure you've all heard many times, but if you have any fundamental tips for those out there, perhaps not quite as far along this process as Samson, now would be a good time to offer some thoughts. Linda, do you have any quick thoughts on building a business case?
I agree with your comment that this is not the right time. I observe it now every day. Samsung is, say, in Corona crisis management mode since more or less January, and it's only increasing. So one advice would be, for any other company in this call, is say, pick the right time, and now that might not be the right time, but do continue focusing on those things that are relevant and that are instrumental in driving change. But don't try to bombard management now with too many things, because the, I would say the focus is rightly so on the health and the well-being of the people and the business.
Thanks very much. Phil, would you add anything to that?
I think that's excellent advice. The only thing I'd add is use this time now to develop that case. And in fact, I would argue that use it, gather the information now about the way in which we would have been far better prepared for the coronavirus, and we will be for the next pandemic, if we'd done better risk management over the last period. And we were able to disclose that and make sure that people knew that across the company, but also across our stakeholders. So that's, you know, use these times now for the right time, as Linda's saying, which is to approach management, which will be later in the year or also.
Thanks very much. Camille, would you like to say anything on that?
Yes, and actually it's something that Linda said earlier, is that when there's more and more ask from different stakeholders for transparency from companies, the risk becomes greater to not disclosing information and not being transparent about what's going on internally, even if it's disclosing about challenges, because we know there are challenges. The question is, what is the company doing to overcome them? So that was, yeah, an essential point for the business case. And for coronavirus, I agree with Phil that companies, it's actually now a really important time for companies to show that they're going beyond their commitments and actually acting to protect their workers in their own operations and their supply chains, and protect those that are most vulnerable. And of course, the situation would be very different for companies depending on their sector and their specific context. And some of are faced with very difficult decisions, even in relation to the survival of their business. So that there isn't the same space and level of expectation for those companies at the moment. But it's in moments like this that leading companies can really step up and demonstrate that they care for their people, as Phil said. And they will also need to be supported through these efforts and to look for guidance in other leading companies.
Thank you, Camille. So one final question for all of you, and then we're going to need to bring this to a close. I've managed to ask about 80% of the questions that came in. Sorry to anyone whose question hasn't been asked. We can't always do them all. So a final question for all of you, which I think is a really interesting longer term one. Beyond benchmarking and standard disclosures, should companies commission and disclose publicly more in-depth evaluative work to understand what's working on the ground and what's not? I imagine the answer all of us would give is yes, but I'm probably looking for a little bit more than one word from each of you on this. So Camille, yes and, I imagine will be your response.
I would say yes, and it's not just about the amount of information disclosed, it's about the quality of the information and the quality of the data. So when looking at, I don't know, cases of forced labor in the supply chain, it's also about the background, the root causes behind those issues, and what companies are doing to address them. And that often involves working with a variety of stakeholders, because those are systemic issues. So yes, but focusing on the quality and not just the quantity of disclosure.
Phil, let me turn to you, and then I'll give the final word to Linda before we close on this point. Phil.
Yes, thanks. That's great. And again, a very important remark as well as question. I think the what I would highlight in this question is really, you know, the one thing we don't need is more announced social audits in supply chains. That those do not constitute the deep dives that are necessary to really find out and evaluate the risks that are being faced by communities and workers, and for companies therefore to be able to take preventive action to avoid them. You know, social audits, it's a multi-billion dollar industry now, and it is too infested with a conflict of interest, leading to a far too much mendacity in terms of what's there. We feel now that in many of the key sectors, much of the social order industry is just is providing plausible deniability to allow the toleration of unacceptable levels of abuse in supply chains. So I think that model is broken. It doesn't mean to say unannounced social audits as part of a broader piece is going to be important. Of course it is. But at the moment, paying 500 quid or insisting that manufacturers pay 500 quid to get a compliance statement is almost certainly never going to give you a deep dive in terms of what's necessary. And so moving towards that deep dive, which is often now a collective effort amongst those in a particular sector that want to know where the risks are in a particular location, a particular geography, in a particular or even a particular manufacturer. And that's what will, I think, start to drive making that start to drive really useful information. If that information is made available, then that could be so empowering to workers, not only in that particular location, but to many others. So I applaud the question and the remark that was held within the question. Back to you.
Thanks very much, Phil. Linda, let me turn to you for a final comment before we close.
Yeah, thank you, Tony. And I just want to compliment what has been said already by Camille and by Phil. I think auditing, you know, whether we like it or not, but we still need to have some form of auditing in place. Is auditing alone enough? No, I think you also will need to focus on education and making sure that there is a better understanding within your own company as well as this within your suppliers about what the expectations are, but also how to identify risk and mitigate those. I think a third element is, having a deep dive via whatever tailored human rights impact assessment that gives you more knowledge and understanding about the root causes. And I think the fourth element is, also here, I think that the collective action across businesses for those topics that you can't deal with you on your own. So it's not an or, it's an and. And it's resource intense, whatever we do, but we really need to make sure that we focus the resources on the right topics and the right issues. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Linda, Camille and Phil, for giving up your time. We've run slightly over, but I think it was worth it for the insights. This session will be available afterwards for you to download. We'll send you a link. There's been plenty of other sessions happening yesterday and today, and I hope you'll find them useful. We are launching a full immersive online conference platform next week and the week after for our future events. So we'll email you some details about that so you can take a look at what a virtual conference looks like that goes beyond this current technology we're using. But I think given the limitations of this technology, our panelists have done an excellent job. So if you could all offer them a silent virtual round of applause, sat at your desks, as I'm sure many of you are at home. And thanks so much for your time today, for taking part. And we will be in touch very soon. So panel, once again, thank you so much and goodbye, everyone.